From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get the latest on Hurricane Irma, which continues its destructive path through the Caribbean today after passing just north of Puerto Rico last night, leaving many residents without power. Models show Irma on course for the Turks and Caicos Islands and possibly the Bahamas. In Florida, evacuations are underway in coastal areas. Governor Rick Scott spoke at a press conference earlier today.
Look at the size of this storm. It's huge. Is wider than our entire state and could cause major and life-threatening impacts on both coasts, coast to coast. Regardless of which coast you live on, be prepared to evacuate.
Joining us now is Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, at one point, Irma's winds were up to 185 miles per hour. What's the state of the storm now?
As of 11 o'clock, we're down to 175. And this afternoon, there will probably be some minor fluctuations. The storm has become just a bit slightly less organized. But Jeremy, I don't know about you. I don't really know the difference between 10 and 20 miles per hour. So I don't know when you get up to that range what it's going to really mean in terms of an impact. This is still a major hurricane, a Category 5 storm. As you know, right now, it's stronger than Andrew and it's larger than Andrew. Mm. Not saying it's going to be an Andrew, but it's important to have perspective that when we wish cast this thing to weaken, when we rejoice and see a drop in miles per hour of 5 or 10 with each advisory, still not going to change much in terms of what it could do if it moves over land.
Still a very major storm. What about the track at this point? Where is it headed?
Well, hurricane watches were just issued from Jupiter Inlet south on the Atlantic coast, Bonita Beach south on the Gulf side. That includes the Florida Keys and Lake Okeechobee. Now, that means hurricane conditions could occur within 48 hours. We also have a storm surge watch. That's a new product from the National Hurricane Center to alert residents along the coast of life-threatening storm surge. The two don't always match up. Hurricane watch is for wind. Storm surge watch is for the life-threatening velocity of water that comes inland and can flood homes. And, of course, that's the number one killer from a hurricane. You asked about timing. I mentioned that because those watches kind of start to tell you that it's coming and it's approaching within 48 hours. Tropical storm conditions are likely to begin from the Keys to Miami. The most likely time frame those will begin is around Saturday afternoon, but residents in those areas should realize that the earliest reasonable time could be before dawn on Saturday. That means preparations have to be completed before sundown Friday. Evacuations have to be completed by then as well. The core of the storm is expected to make landfall. And I want to emphasize this. You look at that cone, you think half of it's over water, half of it's over land. The center of the storm, officially from the Hurricane Center, is expected to pass right over downtown Miami, 8 a.m. on Sunday morning. There's still a large cone of uncertainty, and it's also important to remember that that width of that cone of uncertainty is still wider than the width of the peninsula of Florida in South Florida and nearly two times the width of the peninsula in North Florida.
And if it does turn a bit further to the east, which would be great if it would avoid Florida altogether, but if it does turn just a bit further, couldn't some of the cities further up the east coast of Florida be in trouble?
They could, and it's important to note that just because it makes a jaunt to the east, maybe let's say it's starting to leave South Florida and move a little more offshore, there's some upper-level winds that may pull it back toward the coast in northeast Florida. That's also concerning. If it parallels the coast right up the east side, kind of like Matthew did, then the extent of this potential damage is going to be quite vast along our coastline. Listen, no one in the peninsula of Florida, from Tallahassee to Jacksonville, all the way to the Keys, should let their guard down. I think the only maybe part of Florida that could breathe a little easier this morning is maybe over near Pensacola and Panama City.
As we watch this storm move on the map, and as you say, the center of it could hit downtown Miami, is that the worst part of the storm, the eye?
Well, in a major hurricane, Cat 3, Cat 4, Cat 5, you have damaging and destructive conditions on all four quadrants of the storm. It's very concentric, very evenly distributed. So inland, there will be impacts if it hugs the coast. When the storms are weaker, and sometimes when they start to weaken, they start to have more significant impacts on one side or the other. They become a little more heavily weighted on what's called the right front quadrant of its motion. So we're not talking about that right now, and I don't think anybody should cling to that idea because this is a major hurricane, Category 5, with significant impacts on all four sides. Just look at what it's done already to the northern parts of Puerto Rico, and that was 60 to 80 miles offshore.
What's the traffic like in Florida?
I just had a student, you know, I work here at the University of Florida, that said it took 5 hours to get from Orlando to Gainesville, which is about an hour and 45-minute drive. It's already quite intense on I-75, and we just heard from our partner station WQCS in Fort Pierce that because there are still restrictions on some of the lanes down there, it's certainly already backing up significantly on I-95.
That's Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Let's check in Washington, where President Trump has made another concession to a top Democrat. Today, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi asked Trump to send out a tweet reassuring DACA recipients they would not be deported in the next 6 months while Congress considers a replacement. And the president did. His tweet read, "For all of those DACA who are concerned about your status during the 6 months, you have nothing to worry about. No action!" Exclamation point. Of course, his own attorney general said this week that the program that deferred deportation for 800,000 young immigrants brought to the U.S. by parents before 2007 was illegal. And many so-called dreamers said they were going to go underground. At a press conference this morning, Pelosi acknowledged her phone call with the president.
The president, I think, I'm hoping and I'm praying, and I don't say that as a cliche. I am praying that the president really cares about the dreamers or knows that he should care about the dreamers.
Well, yesterday, the president also shocked members of his own party by cutting a deal with Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer to raise the debt ceiling, the government's ability to borrow, and finance the government until mid-December, as GOP leaders Ryan and McConnell reportedly sat and watched. NPR's Domenico Montanaro is here. Domenico, we talked about that deal yesterday. Today, a tweet at the urging of Nancy Pelosi. What do you make of this?
Well, hi there, Robin. It's funny. The tweet itself was still vague. You know, he said no action in the next 6 months. Well, we all know that's going to be the case, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a heightened level of anxiety for the folks who are eligible under DACA and who've gotten what they thought were protections. So it's still vague. It's unclear what it means. And frankly, for Democrats would be better off. They're taking a big risk in deciding that they are going to trumpet this kind of leverage that they feel like they have now. And I think anyone who tries to think that they're going to view an image of best case scenario Trump is not seeing the full image of Trump.
Adding to that, Nancy Pelosi also told reporters after that meeting on that debt ceiling deal that the president told her he supports and would sign into law legislation that offers a path to legalization for immigrants brought to the country as children and living here illegally. Now, many in his party don't agree. They aren't just looking to remove DACA from President Obama's executive order and make it law. They want to get rid of it.
Well, with what he did yesterday in siding with Democrats on the 3-month extension of the debt limit increase, as well as attaching Harvey funding to that and getting rid of the potential for a government shutdown, I think it sent an earthquake. It sent a tremor, at least, across Pennsylvania Avenue to Capitol Hill, in particular to Republicans, to make them feel like they're unsure how Donald Trump might react, that maybe Trump will go along with Democrats, and maybe he won't. And remember, you know, what he's talked about when it comes to foreign policy and national security, I think applies to domestic politics as well, which is that he wants to be somebody who's unpredictable. And I think that that unpredictability means that we're looking at a Washington right now that is not cleanly divided along two-party lines. We've got two parties, the Democrats, the Republicans, and the Trump party.
Yeah. Well, House Speaker Paul Ryan had said before that deal that the deal was ridiculous. This morning, he seemed more subdued. He told the New York Times it made sense in the context of what also came with the deal, which is hurricane relief.
What the president didn't want to do is have some partisan fight in the middle of response to this. He wanted to make sure that in this moment of national crisis, where our country's getting hit by two horrible hurricanes, he wanted to have a bipartisan response and not a food fight on the timing of the debt limit attached to this bill.
Domenico, it sounds as if he's gotten the memo on this.
Yeah, and I don't think it serves Paul Ryan great to just kowtow to whatever Donald Trump wants, because I think Trump sees that as weakness, and he will kind of feel like he could walk all over Paul Ryan. And I think there's some evidence to that. But Paul Ryan's in a difficult position. He's in a very tight box. He's got these conservatives on one hand who he needs to be able to manage in order to get 218 out of just using his conference, which is very, very difficult to do and almost impossible, as it proved for John Boehner. So his agenda that he'd like to get pushed, he's just going to have to hope that he can get as much of tax reform through his pet issue and get that passed with Donald Trump and get as many of the Republicans on board as he can.
Domenico, I just got a few seconds here, but the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., having a private meeting today with the Senate Judiciary Committee. He'll be asked questions about that meeting he took with a Russian lawyer who promised dirt on Hillary Clinton. Will we be hearing anything about that?
Pretty fascinating. He issued a statement today that he said that he wanted to get information as to the fitness, character, or qualifications of a presidential candidate of Hillary Clinton. So again, another admission from Donald Trump Jr. that he was looking for dirt on Hillary Clinton, and should be interesting to see what else comes of it.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
It's not if, but when Houston's perfect storm will hit. It's much higher than your chances of dying in a car crash or a firearm assault or lightning. Those were some of the opening lines of the Peabody Award-winning ProPublica and Texas Tribune 2016 report, Hell and High Water, which talked about the fears of researchers, scientists, some public officials, that a paved-over Houston would not be ready for the next big storm. And of course, when Harvey came, much of this impermeable city flooded. Last year, there had already been recognition that the Houston Ship Channel, one of the world's busiest shipping lanes, would serve as a funnel for a storm surge. There was talk of building offshore dikes and gates to block water from coming into Galveston Bay. Talk that the floodplains, low-lying ground next to bayous that could absorb runoff, were nowhere near big enough. But Phil Bedient of the Storm Surge Prediction, Education, and Evacuation from Disaster Center at Rice University said, last year, we're sitting ducks, we've done nothing. So, can something be done now? Kia Collier is a reporter and editor with the Texas Tribune who was a member of that award-winning team that wrote Hell and High Water and the follow-up report Boomtown, Floodtown, which looked at Houston's potential to flood. She joins us from Austin, Texas. And Kia, you and your team have a right to say, we tried to tell you. But still, what was it like for you to watch Harvey?
Obviously, we wished we were there under different circumstances because we had been focused a lot on holding, you know, local officials accountable for, you know, not adopting smart development practices over the years, which scientists say has worsened flooding. But to see the human kind of side of it was new for us, and it was really sad to see, especially in poorer parts of town where people didn't have much to begin with, and now they have nothing, literally.
They are the sitting ducks that people said everyone was going to be should a storm like this hit. All right, so let's look forward. You and others talk about how Houston isn't a town that embraces regulation. What are some of the things that you're hoping can happen going forward as Houston recovers?
Limiting development in floodplains. Developers in Houston are still largely able to build in the 100-year floodplain, for example, including infrastructure that slows the runoff that occurs in a storm and impacts, you know, surrounding properties and leads to swollen bayous that run through really populated parts of the city. And so development in floodplains is definitely something that scientists say can be improved. And then, you know, Houston, a lot of people describe it as, you know, a 600 square mile concrete island on top of a swamp. And a lot of what has happened is the paving over of really absorbent prairie lands and wetlands. And local officials have not required developers to leave some open green space. Another thing is there are these two big reservoirs west of Houston that people might have been hearing about that were built in the 1940s to protect downtown Houston, which was then 15 miles away from catastrophic flooding. And a decade since then, development has encroached on those reservoirs. Some developers have even built inside the reservoirs. And so all those homes surrounding them are extremely vulnerable to flooding. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which oversees the reservoirs, they're in this kind of predicament where they're ordered by law to protect downtown Houston, so they have to keep a certain amount of floodwaters inside these reservoirs, but they end up flooding out all these homes surrounding them upstream, and then having to release some downstream and flooding those homes. So that was a huge issue in this flood for Houston.
Well, let's remind people how Houston exploded and grew. In the post-war years, there was an effort to control stormwater. Bayous were literally paved over. They were channelized, you know, converted to concrete culverts. And that becomes just a flashpoint for water to stream down. You had housing subdivisions right next to bayous. Developers, now your colleagues in 2015 at the Houston Chronicle looked at permits issued to developers and found that more than half failed to follow through on Army Corps of Engineers directives that were meant to mitigate the destruction of wetlands. So you could build, but you had to do something to mitigate what you did. And many weren't.
Right. Enforcement has been a huge issue. I mean, government is kind of generally underfunded, and there are not a lot of inspectors for any of these agencies to follow up with developers to see whether they've been following the rules, especially with the Corps of Engineers. Someone has to call and say, this is a problem. And they tell us that they investigate most of the time, but it's just hard to know what happens exactly. And when you drive around Houston, there are developments that you look at that you're like, how is that there? Mm-hmm. It's just mind-blowing that certain, you know, strip malls and housing developments have been allowed to exist. And a lot of the people who live there, do business there, have no idea how vulnerable they are to flooding, largely because they're not in floodplains. The people who live around these massive reservoirs in West Houston are not in floodplains, but they've been massively affected in this flood.
Well, but Harris County, Houston is in Harris County, had the highest annual population growth of any county in the U.S. in 8 of the last 9 years. I mean, people are flocking there. And one of the reasons they're flocking there is that it's affordable housing. And one of the reasons it's affordable housing is that developers aren't following regulations. So how do you solve that?
Yeah. I mean, the cost of living is really good in Houston. And it's always a city that has jobs, particularly with the recent oil and gas boom. It's the energy capital of the country. And people go there to work. It's a serious working town. And I think, you know, local officials have this position of, we don't want to curb that economic prosperity. You know, these environmentalists who say we shouldn't be paving over, you know, wetlands and prairie land are really off base, and they're anti-development.
They're holding us back, yeah.
Right.
But are you hearing things like, let's take a jackhammer to cement sidewalks and make them at least permeable material that water can seep through? Homes have to be raised. Let's not build them again. Let's turn them into green space.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk about next steps that, you know, local officials can take, what home buyers should do, whether they should move back into their homes or pursue buyouts. But the problem, I think, in Houston is that it's largely built out, and it's really hard and very expensive to retroactively go back into, you know, a huge part of the city and tear up concrete. And policies that scientists say, you know, need to be adopted, the opportunity to adopt those is in parts of town that are still growing.
Boy, that just sounds, you know, aren't there people saying, wait, we have to change?
Yeah, one thing that's been discussed a lot that we heard in our reporting last year is requiring developers to install, you know, infrastructure that curbs the runoff rate during storms, like I mentioned earlier, into bayous, which affects everyone downstream. And one thing that the flood control district has tried to pursue in the northwest part of Houston, which is still growing, is imposing some stricter requirements on developers to basically keep a bunch of water from pouring into these bayous and flooding everyone else out downstream.
Well, and you also write about rain.
When we were down in Houston last year reporting on the city's hurricane vulnerability, we actually heard from people more about Tropical Storm Allison in 2001. And the last hurricane to hit Houston was Hurricane Ike in 2008. But people seem to remember Allison more than Ike because it caused a lot more damage. So the difference is, you know, rain-based flooding is the main concern with tropical storms, you know, massive flooding that comes from the ground up. And with hurricanes, the primary concern is storm surge. You know, storm surge is the massive wall of water that a hurricane pushes in front of it. And Houston is also extremely vulnerable to that, especially the refining and petrochemical complex on the east side of Houston.
Well, and then is the mayor of Houston right? Because when people said, you know, maybe there should have been more land use regulation, some of these structures built, Mayor Sylvester Turner said that wouldn't change anything. It would have been a city with zoning that flooded. No one controls Mother Nature.
Yeah, I've been dissecting that quote and wondering what exactly he was meaning by that. And I think the larger point he was making is that you never know where a storm is going to hit. And certainly Harvey dumped a massive amount of rain on Houston. It would have flooded regardless of what developers had been allowed to do or not. But also, I think, to dismiss the extensive scientific research that shows that what local officials in Houston have allowed to happen in terms of paving over absorbent wetlands is pretty irresponsible, I would say. And certainly part of his comment touched on that and dismissed concerns that unsmart development practices have led to a lot of people's homes being flooded. The other point we made in our reporting is the climate change angle, kind of local officials and everyone in government at this point is still kind of looking to the past to plan for future storms, which doesn't make sense now, given that storms are expected to become worse and more frequent as the earth warms and as the oceans warm.
How's that conversation going?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, someone asked me earlier about, will the floodplains be redrawn now? Because so much flooding has occurred outside the floodplain in Houston. And that would be good, I guess. But not only is it going to take years, but I don't think the 100-year floodplain is really the 100-year floodplain anymore. And I think a lot of people acknowledge that the standards for what is a floodplain are outdated and need to change.
Yeah. That's Kia Collier, a reporter and editor for the Texas Tribune. We'll link you to her writing at herenow.org. Kia, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The threat of Hurricane Irma forced the NFL to postpone Sunday's game in Miami between the Dolphins and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. That game will instead be played on November 19th. At least for now, though, the rest of the NFL schedule is intact. That includes the Texans playing the Jacksonville Jaguars in flood-ravaged Houston on Sunday. The season actually kicks off tonight with the defending Super Bowl champion New England Patriots hosting the Kansas City Chiefs. So let's get a preview with Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And the NFL.com site polled 15 experts. Six of them picked the Patriots to win the Super Bowl again. What do you think as we start the season?
That seems low to me. It seems like the only reason you wouldn't want to do that is as an expert, you don't get much credit for picking the Patriots. But who else would possibly be the front runner? It's not just the dearth of competition. They are the best team. Although a case could be made, a plausible case, hear me out, that the Atlanta Falcons, a team that was dominant in the playoffs in the regular season and leading quite mightily in the Super Bowl, but for one play, one boneheaded play here or there, would have won the Super Bowl. Maybe they should be considered something like a co-favorite. But they're a little bit far down on the list, especially if you look at Las Vegas odds, because I think that people believe there will be a hangover effect from losing that game. Some other teams who might be good, I think, in the East, the Steelers, they're as good. They're coming on. The Raiders, especially if their quarterback Derek Carr stays healthy. I said the East. I mean the AFC. And in the NFC, I do think Atlanta is far and away better than their competitors in the NFC.
What about players? Are there some new players emerging as superstars right now?
I'm interested to see how Deshaun Watson plays. He's a rookie quarterback for the Houston Texans, who you just mentioned. They're going to have such a good defense that he won't be asked to do so much, but he was a superstar in college, so that will be exciting. I also mentioned Derek Carr. He's coming on. The Raiders have a high, potent offense, and it's because of Carr. He hurt himself late in the season, and that thwarted their chances in the playoffs. On the other side of the ball in Oakland, Khalil Mack, Defensive Player of the Year, is a third-year player. They don't have a great defense, but he is a great and disruptive player. And then let's maybe for a second talk about Ezekiel Elliott, who was a running back for the Cowboys, fantastic player, but has been suspended for 6 games by the NFL. And where that stands now is he's going to play in week 1. It has to do with the timing of his appeal. The league ruled against him. The arbitrator ruled against him. He's still appealing it. There's a chance he might not serve all 6 games, but I think it's likely that he will. There's a chance that he might not serve all the games this year. But again, I think it's likely that he will.
Okay, so that's the NFL. I want to ask you one question about tennis while we have you. Something very unusual in the U.S. Open. 4 American women in the semifinals tonight. That's very unusual, isn't it?
That is very unusual. And to get there, Madison Keys and Coco Vandeweghe and Venus William and Williams and Sloane Stephens beat two Czechs, an Estonian and a Latvian. So it could have been an all former Eastern Bloc final. And there hasn't been an all U.S. women's finals or semifinals since the days of Chris Everett and Martina Navratilova. Mm. Remember, she became a United States citizen. Right. So even though we bemoan the state of American tennis, that's actually on the men's side, especially with the women being so dominant, and now we're seeing some young players really assert themselves. It's a good day for women's tennis in America.
That's Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
Hey, thank you.
The sister islands of Antigua and Barbuda begin the arduous task today of recovering from Hurricane Irma. The storm hit Barbuda full force with 185 mile per hour winds. Only 22 miles away, Antigua fared better with heavy rains and winds. Carl Joseph is a reporter with the Antigua Newsroom News Agency. He joins us from Antigua. Carl, what are you seeing there today?
Well, day and a half ago, we had Hurricane Irma that hit the Leeward Islands. It hit Antigua first. It passed just north of Antigua, about 40 miles north of Antigua. The center of the island was 40 miles north of Antigua. 22 miles north of Antigua is Barbuda.
Right.
And that's our sister island there. We, here in Antigua, we experienced a lot of wind. We also experienced some rains, hurricane-force winds. I wouldn't say that we got those here in Antigua, but our sister isle of Barbuda got the full brunt of it.
Yeah, Barbuda is being described today as uninhabitable.
Yeah, as per the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda, Gaston Browne. He made a trip. He made an emergency trip over there yesterday afternoon. He tried to get down there earlier, but as he says, the helicopter agencies had said to him that the winds were still too high and there was no other way to get over there until the afternoon. All right, so when he did go, he did do that flyover in over Barbuda. He saw the devastation that happened over there. What he described is that around 95% of the structures, be it homes or businesses or hotels, were completely destroyed. Residents on the island themselves, when they spoke to the Prime Minister, they described, you know, in one instance, there was a house splitting in two with the roof coming off. And that person and their families had to run for shelter in 185 mile per hour winds. All right, so the devastation was great early morning into yesterday afternoon.
But on Antigua, you're saying things are not near as bad?
No, not by a long shot. I interviewed the deputy Met director here in Antigua Barbuda, Dale Destin, yesterday. And what he told me, these are his words, is that we were lucky. I asked him for the scientific definition of lucky, and he said there's no scientific definition. We were extremely lucky to avoid what was to be the greatest forced hurricane that we've ever had in Antigua and Barbuda. 185 sustained winds. I think Irma, where it is now in Puerto Rico, it's still at that sustained wind. And because of that, it's being touted as one of the most devastating hurricanes ever. And we were fortunate enough in Antigua Barbuda to miss that.
At least in Antigua, maybe not Barbuda.
In Antigua, yes, I should say. I'm so accustomed to saying Antigua and Barbuda.
Right,
but
I'm sure.
In Antigua, we were able to miss that, but Barbuda did not dodge that at all. As far as the evacuation plan, there are about 1,500 to 1,800 people living in Barbuda. That's the population over there. It's 62 square miles. And what the Prime Minister has said, especially because there is another looming hurricane in Jose coming right up behind, in a similar path to what Irma would have followed. That is scheduled for us. If it does hit Antigua and Barbuda in our region, it'll hit on Saturday. And what they're saying is that if the projected path stays the same throughout today, they're going to have an evacuation plan for the entire island of Barbuda, because obviously the water systems are down, the electricity there's none, the food and food supplies are nil to none. Those are being ravished as well. So you have agencies trying to fly over today, trying to provide them with water and whatnot. But it is not sustainable the way they are right now. Yes, the Barbudans, when he went over, he did describe them as being in a good mood given the circumstance. But provisions are being made to bring them over to Antigua sometime during the course of this week.
Now, you're joining us by cell phone. Are the communications lines working in Antigua? Is the power on?
The power is about 60% the way on. The APUA, which is our power company here, they have about 24 feeders on the island. And about 16 of those have been restored as of yesterday, and they're continuing to try to restore power. There's no power in Barbuda, and the telecommunications tower, the main one, got destroyed in the storm as well. They had a backup, which was the ham radio. That tower got destroyed as well, and the satellite phone service that they had made a third contingency for, that got destroyed as well. So right now, no one is able to get communications into Barbuda itself.
When was the last time you had to deal with a hurricane like this in Antigua and Barbuda?
Well, the last one leading up to it, the talk was 1995, Hurricane Louis. Hurricane Louis, we didn't even, I mean, when I say we in Antigua and Barbuda, we didn't even get the brunt of it per se, but we got the main part of the outer bands. And that changed our islands, both islands on the Twin Island State completely. The shorelines were changed, roofs and structures were devastated. And it took us 3 months, I think, before we got power back. If memory serves, I was very small at that time. It took us a while to get back to a state of normalcy. For instance, when we got ice for the first time, it was like gold back then. Since then, the structures have improved, the building codes have improved and such, but still, that was the last one that really hit Antigua and Barbuda really hard.
Well, I'm glad that Antigua, at least, was spared for the most part this time. Obviously, our thoughts are with the people in Barbuda as this recovery just gets going. Carl Joseph with the Antigua Newsroom News Agency joining us from Antigua. Thank you so much and best of luck.
And thank you so much for caring.
Well, the Florida Keys are preparing for Hurricane Irma, but some people are staying despite a mandatory evacuation order. One of them is Nancy Klingener, who is Florida Keys reporter for WLRN. She joins us from Key West. Nancy, are there any other people with you there on Key West at this point?
There are. There's a surprising number of people. I've seen people out walking their dogs. I ran into friends of mine this morning when I was going to my office. So there are definitely still people here. There's coffee shops serving coffee like they always do.
But there's been an evacuation order on the Keys, right?
That's right. It's a mandatory evacuation order, and the city and county officials just held a press briefing this morning, and their basic message was, get out.
And to do that at this point, how difficult would that be? Has the road that takes you from the Keys up to Miami just been clogged with traffic?
No, the road is moving well. The problem is gasoline. Just like we're seeing in all of South Florida, gas stations in Key West are just running out of fuel and all along the Keys. So that's the scary part.
So why are people ignoring the evacuation order, do you think?
Well, some people fear that they might run into the storm. You know, if you evacuate to Miami and Miami ends up getting clobbered, that's not nice. Sometimes people just feel like they want to ride it out. This is their home and they don't want to leave. There's a lot of reasons. Some people can't afford it, although the city does have free buses taking people up to shelters on the mainland.
And what about for people who do decide to stay? What are they supposed to do if the storm, you know, hits Key West or the other Keys in a significant way?
They haven't said anything about refuges of last resort because they want people to leave. They don't want people to think there's some reason for them to stay. And a big issue is that our hospitals will be closing tomorrow morning, Friday morning. So there's not going to be an ER. There's not going to be a helicopter that normally takes trauma cases to the mainland. And the first responders are not going to come out and help once the winds get going. So people are really on their own if they stay.
When was the last time Key West had to deal with a hurricane, or how used to this are people there?
Well, we have a pretty high population turnover, so there's a lot of people here who have never dealt with it. The last serious impact we had was from Hurricane Wilma in 2005. That went by us as a Category 3, and it caused a 5 to 6 foot storm surge over a lot of the islands. It caused millions and millions of dollars of damage. People lost their cars. Some people actually lost their homes. And it was pretty tough, but it didn't take out a bridge, it didn't take out our water line, and it didn't kill anybody. So it wasn't catastrophic.
That's Nancy Klingener, a reporter with WLRN, joining us from Key West, which it sounds like is emptier than usual, but there are still people there who are going to brave the storm. Nancy, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're immersed in hurricane watch now. We'll stay on Irma. But this big story is a reminder of how focus can shift. At one time, all eyes were on a city in Iraq, Fallujah, the scene of terrible fighting after the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Many of Saddam Hussein's military leaders lived there. After the U.S. disbanded the army, they lost jobs. The U.S. liberators were seen as invaders. Fallujah was where the four Blackwater contractors were brutally attacked by a mob, hung from a bridge. Later that year, 2004, it was the scene of the bloodiest battle American troops fought in Iraq. It was the first city to fall to ISIS in 2014. The Iraqi army drove ISIS out in 2016, but now Fallujah is shell-shocked. The BBC's Paul Adams spent time in Fallujah this summer. We'll link you to his beautifully illustrated report at hereandnow.org as he joins us from London. And Paul, we see the destruction of Fallujah, but we also see in your pictures a lit-up Ferris wheel and a man who's trying to bring a fairground back. He seems like hope embodied.
I think he was, really, Robin. I mean, he was a guy who had set up this fairground in the months just before ISIS took over. He'd been building it in the course of 2013. It was all ready to go, had pretty much just opened, and then ISIS came to town, and he and many, many other people in Fallujah left. When he came back, he found the place a wreck. But he was determined to pick up where he'd left off, so he ploughed a lot more money into reopening it. And it's a remarkable scene. You know, Fallujah, a year after its liberation, still a place with many problems. And so to see in the midst of a slightly gloomy, dark city at night, this extraordinary, brightly lit ground with the Ferris wheel and all the other rides that you would expect to see in a fairground is a little remarkable, a kind of oasis of light and sound and contentment.
But you point out that you noticed parents who were wary because just a little bit before there'd been an explosion, nobody was killed, but still there's a wariness. The man's name is Anas Al-Janabi, and he spoke to you about that. Let's listen.
We worked very hard to restore the smile on the faces of the children of Fallujah. But ISIS came again and caused an explosion here, and people are scared to come back.
So constant worry that ISIS might come back. And just talk a little bit about how they're living.
We know, oddly enough, Fallujah fared relatively well during the capture by Islamic State and its recapture by the government. It was not flattened in the way that we saw, for example, in the old city in Mosul. There are parts of Fallujah and the surrounding villages that were very, very badly damaged, particularly the southern suburbs of Fallujah. But the heart of the city is not so bad. I mean, clearly showing evidence of destruction over, you know, more than a dozen years. And places where there were clearly airstrikes during the Islamic State years, but it's not too bad.
Well, but they do need help. You spoke to another man outside a mosque. Let's listen.
The security situation is good now, but we were 3 years outside of Fallujah. We back, we found nothing.
Nothing.
There's no houses, no properties. So the Iraqi government or the government should support us. They should help us because there's no opportunity, no work. So someone should help us.
So some people, you know, are coming back and they're not finding their homes. And you write, first of all, the Iraqi government is broke from fighting ISIS. And also many don't trust people in Fallujah because even though they were brutalized by ISIS, they're suspected of supporting ISIS.
You know, it really feels like a city where people feel they're being punished. Punished perhaps for having had the temerity to turn against the government and submit to Islamic State authority. And there are many of them who are still stuck out in the desert because of this cloud of suspicion. They're in displaced camps. They're not able to go back. Some of them have got security clearance, but for one reason or another, they feel unable to go back to the city. Some of them talk about the role of Shiite militias who are out for revenge, and that's certainly an element.
Well, let's remind ourselves why there's that suspicion, because when ISIS first came, there was anger at the government, and they thought, well, maybe this will, you know, maybe this will work. But it quickly didn't. I mean, they were brutalized by ISIS. You have pictures of makeshift little cages. People were kept in these cages. There were signs of torture. You write about a woman who says that the government is suspicious of her sons being in ISIS. And she says, if my sons are in ISIS, I'll slaughter them myself.
Yeah, so fighting talk from that lady in one of those displaced persons camps. I came away with the strong feeling that unless the reconstruction goes on quicker, and unless the people of Fallujah start to feel that they have a place in today's Iraq, then there is a city that could fall again in the future to some insurgent group or other who promises to fight their corner.
Boy, what a symbol of how there are so many different competing factions in a war, and one city can be buffeted by all of them. The BBC's Paul Adams from London, and again, we'll link you to his incredible reporting at herenow.org. Paul, thank you.
Nice to be with you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.